Good afternoon, and welcome to the Cato Institute briefing on AI, Artificial Intelligence, and American Innovation. My name is Jennifer Shulp, and I'm the Director of Financial Regulation Studies at the Cato Institute Center for Monetary and Financial Alternatives. I'm excited to be hosting this great panel today to talk about a topic that's top of mind for just about everyone, from consumers to workers to students to policymakers. From the techno-optimists to the doomers, and everyone in between, conversations about artificial intelligence touch on a host of policy areas, including data privacy, cybersecurity, financial opportunity, election integrity, economic growth, and more. As policymakers consider what course to chart on AI regulation, it's important to keep in mind that new technology, no matter how transformative, does not mean that we should abandon long-standing policy principles that have served America and American innovation so well. We're fortunate to have with us today three experts to talk about those principles and how to think about AI policy. To my left is Jennifer Huddleston, a senior fellow in technology policy at the Cato Institute. Her research focuses on the intersection of technology and law, including issues related to the governance of emerging technologies such as AI. Just last month, she testified before the House Oversight Subcommittee on Cybersecurity, Information Technology, and Government Innovation about the Biden administration's recent executive order on AI. Next is Jack Soloway, who is a policy analyst in Cato's Center for Monetary and Financial Alternatives, where he focuses on financial technology, including the use of artificial intelligence in financial services. Jack's recent writings on AI have appeared in the Regulatory Review, Law 360, and National Review Online. And at the end is Professor Pedro Domingos, a professor emeritus of computer science and engineering at the University of Washington. He has won the SIG KDD Innovation Award and the Ichikai John McCarthy Award, two of the highest honors in data science and AI. He is also the author of The Master Algorithm, which explores machine learning and the race to build computer intelligence as flexible as human, and which Amazon tells me is recommended by Bill Gates. We'll hear from each of our three panelists, and then we'll have lots of opportunity for questions. So to all of you in the audience, get your questions ready, and let me turn it over to Jennifer.
Thank you, Jennifer, and thank you all for coming out to be with us this afternoon. This has certainly been a topic that there's been no shortage of conversation on, both here on the Hill as well as in popular culture. In fact, it seems like over the last 18 months or so, AI is everywhere. And unfortunately, we've seen a lot of dystopian visions of what that means. It seems like every time we hear about AI, we hear about the bad instead of the good. And oftentimes, the benefits are buried down. But AI didn't just appear 18 months ago. One of my least favorite questions that I sometimes get as a technology and policy research fellow is, how often do you use AI in your work? And the reason I hate that question is because typically what people mean is generative AI. They're asking questions about things like ChatGPT. But the reality is, we've all been using AI in our work on an everyday basis for a lot longer than we may realize, whether it's running a Google search, using autocomplete in an email, or talk to text on your phone, we've been using AI in many beneficial ways already. This gets even more to be the case when we think about some of the incredible research that's going on using AI. Whether it's finding personalized cancer treatments, or helping to better predict wildfires, or helping to prepare for better cybersecurity, AI has an incredibly important role to play in a wide variety of fields. So as policymakers start to think about what, if anything, should be done with AI, I think it's important that we take a step back and first ask that question of, can we even define what AI is? It's important to be very specific when we're talking about this topic, not to lump everything together, because AI has so many different uses. We can take some lessons from our last general technology revolution, and that was the internet. One of the things that allowed the U.S. to be such a leader when it comes to internet policy was our light-touch approach. While the Europeans chose to engage in heavy-handed regulation, the U.S. instead set a policy that allowed the internet to be presumed free until proven guilty, basically. There were some areas where we determined that harm was likely enough to need some small amount of regulation, or where clarity was necessary for innovation. But in general, our early internet policy set at a federal level that we would allow innovators, the market, and consumers to determine the best applications of this tool, and not government bureaucrats. The reality is that that led to more innovation than most of us could have predicted, and benefits and applications that we couldn't have assumed 30 years ago at the start of the internet. The same is true with AI now. I can't sit here and tell you what all the potential beneficial applications might be, because we don't know how this technology could grow. But what I do know is heavy-handed regulation that does not narrowly fit the specific harms could squash those beneficial applications in an overly broad situation. This also goes to looking at what else is going on in the policy landscape. This isn't just a federal question. We've also seen a growing number of states act, something that could create a disruptive patchwork that could create problems for innovators who want to launch their products across the US. We also increasingly see that European regulation targets American companies in ways that makes it more difficult for them to innovate. So how should policymakers actually think about the questions? Is it only a matter of time before the Terminators rise up? Are we in an AI doomsday scenario? Or, as I would posit, is it actually more optimistic? And this is something where policy can play a role in helping to allow a framework that would allow the US to remain a leader in this next digital revolution. I think there are a few key things to consider here. The first is, how do we approach the benefits as well as the harms? If we only focus on the harms, we may never get the benefits of a new technology. We must ask important questions about trade-offs, and if we're trying to have policy that responds to specific harms, narrowly tailor those policies to those specific harms. This leads to two other questions when it comes to AI. Are these harms actually new harms? Are these actually new policy questions? Or are we merely seeing a new version, a new technology applied to our existing policy debates when it comes to issues like speech, misinformation, fraud, or more? Second, I would suggest that we need to ask the question, is this actually about the technology, or is this about bad actors using the technology? We want to make sure that any kind of policy regarding AI is targeted at the right concern. We shouldn't just focus on the technology itself, but look at whether our existing regulation may already alleviate the concerns that some policymakers and the public may have. AI is a general purpose technology, and as such, broad approaches are unlikely to be successful and could create more trade-offs than good. Instead, we need a much more balanced approach that encourages innovation, allows the market to respond, and if there are harms, as we learned with the internet, to only focus on very specific elements that are generally agreed upon and to try to narrowly tailor that policy as much as possible. In fact, even in heavily regulated sectors like finance, as Jack will discuss, there are incredible opportunities to use technology in new ways that would actually encourage innovation and encourage democratization to allow more people more opportunities to interact with different systems. We have to be careful of the negative trade-offs that regulation could have. Finally, I would like to point out that the incredibly disruptive nature of AI shows once again that oftentimes innovation remains our best competition policy. If we allow innovation to continue, we can see the market evolve in new ways that we couldn't have predicted. This allows further economic development as well as further opportunities for consumers to have the products that they may have never dreamed of before. Particularly in our growing digital age, AI products will continue to empower global productivity and provide new opportunities for citizens around the world. And with that, I'll turn it over to Jack.
Thank you so much, Jennifer, for that helpful overview. Excuse me. I'm going to zoom in, as Jennifer mentioned, on how in the financial services sector, we actually see one of the first practical applications of AI, which has been around in this diverse field for decades. Do this in order to see what lessons we can draw from the use of AI in the wild. So as a quick roadmap, I'm going to cover the historic links between AI and finance, some key applications of AI to financial services, and the benefits we see from them. The typical policy concerns we hear with respect to AI as applied to finance, and lastly, a pro-innovation framework for thinking about the trade-offs, as Jennifer mentioned, between opportunities and risks. Now, I think it's worth noting that finance was very much present at the creation when it comes to AI. In fact, and I believe this is the same John McCarthy that Jen mentioned with respect to Professor Domingos's award, he's really credited with coining the term artificial intelligence in the US context vis-a-vis a 1955 research project at Dartmouth. And it's worth noting that one of his co-authors on the research proposal was Claude Shannon, the father of information theory and an early experimenter with mathematical models for investing, and someone who taught the folks who would eventually become the leaders in the field of quantitative finance, which was one of the earliest practical applications of machine learning in the wild. So what is quantitative finance and why does it matter? Quant finance simply is a field of trading and investing that leverages math, statistics, and computer science to identify patterns and make predictions about markets. The foundations were laid in the 1950s to the 1970s, including with models that won Nobel Prizes. And in the late 1980s, we began to see machine learning applied to analyze large data sets and identify patterns among complex variables in the markets. So why does quant trading matter? Why is this field important? For one, the market participants that employ this strategy have been some of the most successful in the world. While their secret sauce is often a closely guarded secret, it is an area of competitiveness for the US. But beyond the success of specific market participants, the background conditions that quantitative finance produces in the market helps allow for greater and lower cost retail investor participation in the markets by adding liquidity and helping with efficient price discovery. In addition to trading and investing, AI has played a really important role in protecting consumers from fraud, particularly in the payment card context. And that's been going on for over three decades now. In fact, one of the earliest applications of artificial neural networks to this problem occurred not last week, not last year, but actually in the early 1990s. And similar to the quantitative finance example, again, this is a matter of identifying patterns to make predictions. And in the case of identifying fraud, it's a question of identifying anomalies to try to suss out when bad actors, as Jennifer mentioned, are simply put committing fraud in this context. And in the decades following the launch of these tools, there was a dramatic drop in the rates of credit card fraud. And while this is an evolving threat picture, and it's something of an arms race and one should never grow complacent, overall, these tools are absolutely essential components of the arsenal of anti-fraud and consumer protection. Today, we see a diverse array of applications of AI to financial services, far more than we could possibly enumerate today. But suffice it to say that across subfields in finance, from banking to accounting to investment advising, and across functions from customer-facing roles to strategy to back office and administrative work, AI has both established and experimental applications. And again, while we don't have the time to get into every single granular benefit of all of these applications today, the high-level takeaway I want to leave you all with is that the application of labor-saving technologies to financial services allows consumers to access more and cheaper financial services, tools that were typically reserved for folks who were well-heeled and well-connected through digitization, through algorithms that allow for predictions and recommendations more seamlessly. Folks, more Americans, more diverse Americans have gained access to these essential products and services. Now, obviously, as Jennifer mentioned, this space has both opportunities as well as risks. And I want to break down some of the typical risks that we hear about from policymakers and regulators in this context. And there's different ways to sort of cut and categorize these. But I actually think it sort of falls into three buckets, the risks we typically hear associated with AI and finance. And the first is the question of performance. Simply, will a tool do what it says on the tin? And I think this category includes the subcomponents of competence. Again, will a chatbot, for example, help a customer resolve their customer support need, as well as the questions of protecting data for both cybersecurity and data privacy purposes. The next high-level category is transparency, the question of whether an AI tool is obscuring information in a way that we should be concerned about. And this includes the subcategories of a topic, and a topic we hear a lot about, which is algorithmic bias, whether because of the training data that might be skewed based on historical discrimination and patterns, the outcomes of algorithmic processes might reproduce historic underrepresentation. Similarly, in this context, explainability, the idea that AI models might be opaque both to the users and the producers, comes up a lot because it can potentially create complications for existing legal frameworks that require lenders and creditors to basically explain their work. And lastly, one of the topics we hear a lot about is systemic risk. And while there's a lot that could be said about that in finance generally, in the AI context, systemic risk often involves the claim that concentration in the model, in the market for foundation models, will lead to what's known as herding behavior. A lot of market participants all moving in the same direction and therefore magnifying risks in the event of something like a market downturn. Now, these are a lot of topics. There's a lot that could be said about them, but I'm gonna briefly touch on each one within the context of a pro-innovation framework, very similar to the one that Jennifer laid out a moment ago. First, it's important to validate assumptions about risks. And the simple question is whether AI is actually introducing greater risks in the financial services context. And we see an important example of this, I think, with respect to the systemic risk claim. There's a lot of questionable assumptions that are built into that claim, including the idea that we will see market concentration with respect to foundation models. Now, that's entirely possible, but it really remains to be seen whether that ultimately will be the equilibrium. And secondarily, it doesn't necessarily follow that even if you have concentration in the market for foundation models, that all market participants will move in the same direction. Their incentives typically are to gain an edge over their competitors. Every little bit, every scrap of information that they could collect could be used to fine-tune models to give them a leg up on their competitors and make them more profitable. My second recommendation in this pro-innovation framework is that we need to take a surgical and outcome-oriented approach to mitigating risks. And I think the bias conversation is very illuminating here. Because on the one hand, we do have a lot of existing laws and rules covering equal credit opportunity, covering fair lending, that have, for the most part, led to relative caution on the part of creditors and lenders when it comes to deploying black box and more sophisticated models. So we do have laws and rules that already address policy concerns here, but in addition, they potentially could prove counterproductive where they get in the way of more sophisticated and advanced models, which have the promise and the potential to actually expand credit opportunity and financial inclusion by leveraging alternative data sources. So it's worth taking a look at the existing framework and see where it's getting in the way of some of the important and laudable policy goals that I think a lot of us share. And lastly, the third component of this framework is that we always need to be alert to unintended consequences. And the questions here are, what are the lost benefits of an intervention? And in what cases will a policy recommendation potentially be magnifying risk? One example here, I think, is in the competence and data protection category of risk. For example, there's some concern that open source AI models, which are not centrally controlled by an intellectual property holder, so allow more folks to deploy these in the wild potentially. We hear concern about this from regulators, but we need to be very careful that we don't over-regulate this space, because these very tools, which allow folks to spin up their own models on their own hardware, potentially could resolve the very market concentration and cybersecurity risks that policymakers are also concerned about. So again, it's absolutely vital that we not both put the cart before the horse and end up making matters worse for ourselves by rushing to judgment here. And with that, I'm going to turn things over to Professor Domingos.
Thanks, Jack. There are a lot of misconceptions surrounding AI. And unfortunately, those misconceptions feed directly into a lot of the both fear and the hype surrounding AI. So what I would like to do in these few minutes is to try to give you a more accurate picture of what AI really is, and then see what some of those implications are for what we need and don't need to do about AI and how best to handle it. The term artificial intelligence is a double-edged sword. If instead of calling artificial intelligence, as was the runner-up proposal at this conference that Jack mentioned, we called it complex information processing, it would not be nearly as sexy, but in many ways it would be much more accurate. And so as you hear talk about AI, you have to remember that when we hear the term intelligence, because humans and other animals are the only intelligences we know, this is just how our brain works. We immediately project onto these AIs all sorts of human qualities that they just don't have. So we have to be able to see through that. So what is AI really? Now, there is a sort of like popular definition of AI, which is not incorrect, but is a little misleading, which is it's automating the things that traditionally only humans could do, like reasoning, vision, language, planning, understanding speech, et cetera, et cetera. And this is not wrong, but let me actually give you what actually is the true technical definition of AI, because that, I think, is very illuminating for a lot of things. Computer science deals with a wide range of problems, most of which can be solved efficiently. When you use a database, when you use your ATM, when you use the web, the problem is being solved exactly as it should be in a short amount of time given a few computing resources. Unfortunately, there are a lot of problems in this world that just cannot be solved efficiently. They require exponential time. As the size of the input goes up, the amount of processing that you have to do goes up exponentially, which means that there is no way to solve them reliably exactly every time. We have to resort to what are called heuristics. And a lot of these problems that we humans are very good at dealing with, like language and reasoning, are precisely, and vision and so on, are precisely of that form, which is why they fall into the purview of AI. But there's another very important aspect that these problems have, which is, while they are very hard and expensive to solve, they're actually easy, quick, and efficient to check the solution. You could have an exponential amount of power solving a very hard problem and no trouble at all actually checking whether it was solved to your desire. So for example, solving a puzzle is hard, but checking whether a puzzle is solved, you just have to look at it. And you really could think of what AI is doing every day as solving very, very, very large puzzles. But at the end of the day, we can still look at it and see, well, did this do what it was supposed to or not? Okay? For example, suppose you create an AI to cure cancer. This is a real big application. Curing cancer is beyond probably the mind of any one human being, far beyond. But, we can tell whether the patient, lived or died, or whether they had, bad side effects or whatnot. Okay? So digging down one level deeper, every AI system, or to be precise, every machine learning system, which is what drives AI, but really most AI systems, has three components. And I think if only people understood what these three components are and what they're for, we would have a vastly more enlightened discussion about AI. So what are they? The first component is representation, is the choice of language in which the AI learns and reasons. We have that too. We have English and Chinese and Spanish and whatnot. And in programming, right, there's programming languages like Java and Python and C. In AI, there are those representations as well. The most famous one these days is neural networks. It's basically imitating the brain, but there are several others. The second component, and one that I think is going to be most important for our purposes, is what we call evaluation. Every machine learning system is optimizing an often ridiculously simple, extremely well-defined measure. It's just trying to maximize that. So for example, in the case of social media, infamously, it's engagement. All of this data and computing and intelligence is just trying to increase how engaged you are in the platform. Or if you're Google, the click-through rate on your ads, for example, for a company, the profit that you make, for a regular consumer, some measure of their well-being or happiness. So this thing that is being optimized is very well understood and very precise. There's no mystery about it. And in fact, we have complete transparency into it. Then there is a very often large and complicated search process by which the system finds what is the best model, what is the best strategy that using this language maximizes this measure. And people often get very fixated on that, but I would submit that for the public and for policymakers, that just doesn't matter. All that matters is that it be done efficiently. Here's an analogy. You have a car, you drive a car. How the engine works is for the mechanics. As long as it keeps working, you know, you want it to be fast and efficient and whatnot, but the engineers, the mechanical engineers deal with that. What you really do want to know, however, is where the steering wheel and the pedals are and how to use them. The so-called objective function, the evaluation measure, the metric that we optimize is the steering wheel and the pedals of the car, of the AI. So if you want to make decisions about what we actually do, if you want to have societal influence, if you want, you know, if you want policy about what AI should do, that should go into the evaluation function, not into the representation, which really, you know, doesn't change things that much at this level, not into the optimization or the details of how the algorithms work. So very important to keep these three components in mind. Now let me touch briefly on four, what I would say are probably the four biggest classes of danger that people worry about AI, and how this more accurate picture maybe, you know, enables us to deal with them a little bit better. So the first one is jobs. Everybody's very worried that AI is going to lead to a jobs apocalypse, right? Because, you know, intelligent machines, they can do what we do, and so they're going to replace humans and I'm going to lose my job. This is a very natural fear if you think of AI as a drop-in replacement for a human. But AI is not a drop-in replacement for a human. Any given job is composed of many different tasks. And the most important thing about AI is that because it is a very different type of intelligence from ours, it is good at different things. AI is very good at some things that we are bad at, but there's also other things. Typically, in any given job, there's a set of tasks, some of which AI can do very well, and the others not nearly as well as humans right now and maybe for a long time. So what is typically going to happen is that if you have a job, you can use AI to automate these things, and then you become more productive at the others. It's not that the job goes away. In fact, if you think about this from an economic point of view, AI really boils down to one thing. It's lowering the cost of intelligence. And while intelligence, when something becomes cheaper, typically what happens is that the demand goes up. That's just economics 101. So what we're going to see is not fewer jobs, but a vast gamut of things being done with intelligence that just couldn't be done before because they were too expensive. Now they become cheap, and everybody can have them. And we can do them a million times more. And there are many classic examples of this, from ATMs that actually led to more employment in the banking sector, to machine translation, where there are actually more translators now, and, you know, many, many more times, many more things being translated. So the effect of AI on the jobs market is not to make jobs disappear, it's to actually to create a lot of new jobs. And also, when another piece of economics that is very relevant here is that, like, when the cost of a good goes down, the value of the complementary goods goes up. Right? If the cost of bread goes, if bread becomes cheaper, the demand for butter goes up, and vice versa. And humans are the complement to AI. A lot of the human judgment that we have, that AIs don't, becomes even more valuable when there's a lot of intelligence. So the picture for jobs, actually, contrary to all the doom that you see, is actually, from AI, is actually very, very positive. And by the way, there's another thing, which is our societies are aging. If we want to keep our standard of living, I would say that without AI, we are in deep trouble. If we hamstring AI, then we are going to be in trouble. Another category of things that people worry a lot about is disinformation. And the picture that people have is, you know, AI is going to lead to a flood of disinformation. It's going to be a threat to democracy, et cetera, et cetera. Now, hold on. First of all, the effectiveness of all the known AI that is used by all these companies, you know, Meta, Google, et cetera, at influencing you is actually very low. They don't tell you that because it runs counter to their business. They can't go around telling people, you know, our stuff actually doesn't work that well. But you know it doesn't work that well. Like, how many times have I actually clicked on an ad that Google puts next to your search results? I never have, right? That's just one example. And many studies have been done of like how much do social media actually influence people, and the answer is very little. It's just one more thing that, you know, people use in their strategies, but like nobody's swayed by what you see on social media. So the idea that when AI does this, it's gonna be suddenly fantastically better is dubious at best. Right now, humans are much, much better at manipulating AI, as we've have with all these like so-called, you know, ChatGPT jailbreaks. AI knows nothing whatsoever about manipulating people. And there's only so well that you can get, so good that you can get at manipulating people. The real bottleneck is your attention, and that one isn't going away. So having more AI, I don't think, is going to change the picture that much on that side. On the other side, however, of controlling misinformation, AI is absolutely crucial. The number one tool for combating AI online at places like Facebook, Instagram, et cetera, is AI. I know a lot of the people who do this. Without AI, we would be flooded with misinformation because there's no amount of human labor that can be monitoring the things that that humans produce. So that's another one to bear in mind. A third one, which has already been touched on, is bias. So there is this notion you see in the media constantly that AI is a cesspool of bias and it's perpetuating unfairness and so on and so forth. Again, this comes from this misconception that inside, sometimes we call it the homunculus fallacies, that inside every AI is a little man with all his biases and, you know, messed up things in their minds. There is none of that in AI. In fact, if you look at a learning algorithm the way I just described it, it is mathematically impossible, I repeat, mathematically impossible for that algorithm to have biases about race or gender or any such thing. Like, think of a linear regression model. Does it have biases about sociological variables? It doesn't even know that they exist. Now, you can put all the biases you want into an algorithm that you design, but machine learning, the algorithm is not designed by you. There are, of course, biases that can come from the data, and those need to be, you know, looked at carefully. But the important thing about the data is that it be an accurate representation of the world. What you see a lot of today, including in products that we use, is, first of all, tampering with the algorithm to remove biases that aren't there, and as a result, introducing biases that weren't there, and also tampering with the data to make it look more like we think the world should look, as opposed to what it really looks like, which to me is a little Orwellian and a little alarming. So finally, there is the whole extinction danger, right? And again, we worry that AI is going to exterminate humanity because we project onto AI emotions, desires, consciousness, the will to power, all of that, none of that is there. AI is a bunch of tools. And they will give power to those who use them. The AI is controlled by its objective function, and no matter how much it learns, it can't deviate from that. Machine learning is essentially an accelerated evolutionary process where any system that doesn't fit your objective function immediately goes extinct. You don't worry that your dog is going to kill you at night, but a dog is just a wolf that we domesticated. The AI is actually not only domesticated by us, they're completely created and monitored by us. And again, checking what they do is easy. The problem that they're solving is hard, but I can well imagine in the future a very large fraction of humanity having as their full-time occupation checking that AI is doing what they're supposed to do. In fact, we should be doing that, each one of us. Every day we're checking that the AI is doing what it's supposed to do. So this notion that the AI is somehow going to break out of control is a bit of a fantasy. Now, if these dangers are overblown, and briefly, what are some of the dangers that we do need to worry about? Because don't get the impression that there aren't any. The number one danger in AI that unfortunately gets very little airplay, but that is a real and present danger doing damage every day today, as opposed to hypothetical, you know, thing that might happen, is artificial stupidity. These models, in every domain where they're applied, they don't know what you and I do. They just learn from some data. They make mistakes because they have no common sense. And that means someone who should get credit doesn't. That means that maybe the wrong people get a job interview, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. In medicine, you know, even more importantly, like, you know, it can give you the wrong diagnosis or the wrong advice to various professionals, from judges to doctors to us, et cetera. The way to combat this danger is to increase intelligence. All of these proposals that we see every day and implemented in places like Europe, they're trying to limit AI and constrain it because it's so dangerous. This is incredibly counterproductive. Intelligent AI is safe AI. Stupid AI is unsafe AI. So what we need to do is help AI do all it can do for us, not keep trying to stop it and limit it. The other big class of dangers is bad players, which again have already been touched on. Whether they are totalitarian states, which unfortunately can make very good use of AI for their purposes, or just criminals. But again, we can't do anything about these. The only thing we can do is defeat the people using them with better AI in our hands. So we, the democracies, need to start maximizing the use of AI to make democracy better, just like, you know, dictators are using AI for their purposes. And the law enforcement agencies, the justice system, they need to have better AI to beat the criminals, right? Bank robbers use cars to get away from you know, after they rob a bank. This is not a reason to say cars shouldn't be able to go faster than horses. This is a reason to give the police faster cars than the bad guys have, okay? So what can government do? What are good, you know, some good things, you know, for regulators, legislators to look at? Let me just mention a few. One is that, again, very similar to the internet, there is a patchwork of regulations about AI growing in the states that is incredibly counterproductive. We need uniformity, we need consistency, we need a level playing field. The federal government is the right place for that, number one. Number two, we shouldn't think about AI as like, oh, we need to make these new laws for it. Maybe in some cases we do, but what we need to do is we need to go through the existing laws that were all made with human decision makers in mind and see how it changes them. Again, there are laws to guard against mistakes and biases the humans have. In many cases, the ones that AI have are different. So in some cases, you know, regulations can be loosened or removed because the danger, in the case if things are being AI, because those dangers aren't there. In other cases, there are new ones and there maybe we need new things, but we need to give time for us to understand what AI is doing because AI evolves very rapidly. And this leads to my final thought, which is the following. And I know this is, may not be something that happens tomorrow, but it's something that I need to that we really need to be thinking about. The whole point about AI is that it's incredibly adaptive. It adapts faster and more than humans do. It adapts faster and more than any rigid set of laws can ever do. A rigid set of laws maybe is good for cars, maybe it's good for airplanes, but for AI, it's guaranteed to either allow things that it shouldn't, forbid things that it should allow, or probably some combination of the two. We need the framework, yes, but what we need is for the government to be using AI itself. When you're dealing with companies that have advanced AI, you as a government agency have no choice but to have AI as well. And then you have a dialogue between AIs that are controlled by humans on either side. And this is, I think, how a mature AI-based economy and polity will run. And with that, I will hand it back to Jen.
Yeah, I would say thank you, all three. You raised an awful lot of issues, and I hope that there's some good questions to ask our panelists. So opening up the floor for anyone that has questions, just feel free to raise your hand, and I will point as best I can. Blue suit.
Professor Dominguez, you mentioned updating existing laws to reflect intelligence. There's been articles and stuff recently where it's like between the big tech companies like Meta, Google, and Microsoft now. So they're like competing for training data almost, like copyright issues. When you say updating existing laws to reflect artificial intelligence, would that include regulation that like maybe
Great question. Copyright is definitely an example of an area where we need some revisions. So as it stands now, there are a bunch of lawsuits saying that these various companies are infringing copyright. To paint with a broad brush, for the most part they aren't. Because for example, if you are a painter and you see a lot of Picasso and Van Gogh paintings and they influence you and then you do your own paintings, right? Your own paintings aren't plagiarizing them, right? This is like well within fair use. But the bigger point, and again, this is actually not just the theme in copyright, but a lot of other things, is that at the end of the day, what do we want, right? We want the producers of the content that the AI then does whatever its thing is, image generation, text generation, answering questions, solving processes. We want them to be rewarded. Because if they're not rewarded, then they will stop producing those things, right? So a lot of the mining that has happened, for example, of things like Reddit and Stack Overflow for code and whatnot, yes, maybe we're going to use a chatbot instead of Stack Overflow, but then Stack Overflow will die, and that doesn't work either. So I think we're going to need to have a system by which, you know, the rewards, for example, I answer a question for you, help you write a piece of code, you know, help you write a book or whatever. You get to keep some of that money. You the producer, you the company, you the AI. But then some of that needs to flow to all the pieces, you know, that all the people, et cetera, that contribute to that. The good news is we can do that. The PageRank algorithm that made Google what it is precisely an algorithm to do this kind of distributed assignment of credit. It basically says your page is valuable and good to point, you know, to return to you. If a lot of pages point with that themselves, there are a lot of pages pointing to them. And for example, and this comes from Bibliometrics, which is scientific research. So I can very well see a system like that, you know, being used, right? And being, again, leading to an explosion of creation of knowledge and its application and whatnot. Now, what we need is a framework that lets this happen without trying to decide how it's going to happen. How it's going to happen is up for grabs. There will be innovation, there will be different ways to do this, and we'll see what happens. But this is the revision that we need.
If I can jump in as well and to build off of something that Professor Domingo's already said, I think it's important that any approach be not only looking at regulatory options, but also deregulatory options. This kind of accounting of what's already on the books should look both directions. So there may be some cases where concerns about AI are already addressed by existing code, or where there's some kind of clarification that's just needed to say of if you are a bad actor and you use AI to commit fraud, you're still guilty of committing the fraud even though you used an AI tool to commit the fraud. The AI tool isn't guilty, you, the bad actor, human, are. But there are also other cases where there may be presumptions about a human operator or a human decision maker that are actually preventing AI from being applied in certain fields. So a good example I think of with this is the autonomous vehicle example. So you brought up the idea of you need to know where the steering wheel and the pedals are. Well, that's a different situation when you have an AI operating a vehicle and a remote operator, perhaps hundreds of miles away, that's controlling the AI or that's controlling that autonomous vehicle or controlling an entire fleet of, say, autonomous vehicle delivery vehicles. So are there also places, particularly in existing highly regulated areas like transportation, like medicine, like financial services, where there actually is a need for clarity and deregulation that allows AI experimentation and innovation, where existing regulation presumes that it will always be a human operator?
Okay, other questions? Go over here. Yeah.
Yep. I appreciate the financial origin of AI and how that allows some concentration of wealth among certain people that were kind of on the ground floor. And one of my main concerns is, given our democracy and checks and balances, and what we see with things being classified, secret, top secret, and so forth, and knowing that the most powerful parts of the government are really operating behind a highly classified system. And I'm thinking about the CIA and various military industrial operations. And then we have the income disparity United States between essentially the wealthy and the vast population. It seems to me that AI, from a democracy standpoint, and the ability of Congress, a committee in Congress, for example, we had the Church Committee at one point that was able to get some visibility into the inner workings of these parts of the government. Could you talk a little bit about how much of AI is going on in classified areas, and how we keep an eye on that, make sure that Big Brother, for example, isn't kind of concentrating the knowledge and the power even more, even worse than it is right now.
Since finance was mentioned, I'll take a first crack at that. I don't have any specific or particular insight into the use of AI in the intelligence field, particularly any clandestine uses by definition. But I think your question, the core of it about sort of democratization versus concentration is an interesting one in the AI context. And I believe that AI is a tool for democratization. In the case of finance specifically, even the quant traders created the background conditions for more liquidity in the markets and better price discovery that could help retail investors actually get access to lower cost trades and financial services. As Professor Domingos mentioned, what we're really talking about here is lower cost intelligence. So AI actually puts more capabilities in the hands of the average person than ever before. And I think it's notable that a lot of these innovations have come specifically from the private sector. Now, I do think that there are policies that could help promote the and enhance the democratizing aspects of AI. And that includes not being overly restrictive with respect to open source models, and generally not being overly restrictive with respect to decentralized and autonomous technologies. So I do think that there is a lot of potential for AI actually to put more capabilities in the hands of the average person.
Like Jack, I can't speak to any specifics of any AI use in clandestine operations or anything like that. But I think this question raises a good point in that it's important to consider the use of AI by the government, but I think it's also important to consider this both ways. As Professor Domingos pointed out, there are opportunities for the government to use AI in productive ways, particularly when they're interacting with other AI systems, but I think also for things that many congressional offices may deal with on a daily basis, things like constituents that are trying to connect with certain services, things like the VA being able to use the best medical technology. We certainly don't want it to become a pure dichotomy of government can't use this technology and the private sector can, because there are beneficial applications for particularly constituents to connect with their government in many ways. And I think that also provides the government with a real opportunity to change the narrative around AI as well, the opportunity to really show individuals how AI is helping them in their lives, how it's improving the use of any taxpayer resources, or how it's improving their ability to connect with each other. That being said, there have been important questions raised about the potential use of AI in ways that could violate civil liberties. And just like other technologies, I think it's important that we recognize any kind of restrictions that may need to be put into place for deploying a technology with civil liberties in mind. So if AI is being used in certain law enforcement scenarios or in certain criminal justice scenarios, do we have certain elements that say require police to get a warrant before using certain AI technologies? Are there other cases where we want to have clarity around how civil liberties are being preserved in order to provide that greater certainty that there is, you know, a respect for the Fourth Amendment or for other elements that may be at play here?
When you talk about regulating cars, cars exist in a physical place. It's easy to say these are the laws for the United States. With AI, given that it's world-based, does it make sense to regulate it here, or should we be working on international considerations for it? You know, individual countries might want to have more restrictive restrictions, but should there be worldwide, should we be working on worldwide standards?
Well, I would say the following. Here's the reason why it really makes sense to have AI being regulated separately in different countries, is that different societies are different. The solution for how to best handle AI is going to be different in America and in India and in Europe and in, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So there is no choice but to do some regulation at the national and even and even lower levels. Now, having said that, your point is valid that AI is a worldwide phenomenon, and it's very hard to separate what I do with AI here from what somebody does, for example, with AI in Europe. And you've probably all heard of the Brussels effect, which is basically that Europe regulates something and then the entire world just regulates the same way because the tech companies don't want to have to make a different product for Europe and for other places. And the Europeans, of which I'm originally one, by the way, are very proud of this. Unfortunately so, because what that means is actually that bad ideas spread. In some ways, what we need to do is need to contain the spread of those bad ideas. And in fact, the tech companies are now at the point where they are starting to say, we are going to have a different product for Europe and for America, for example, or for the rest of the world. And in some ways, I think that is very welcome because then we will get to see which one works better. We know what happened with the internet. What's happening with AI right now, for example, with Europe vis-a-vis the US, is like that, only probably even worse. So what we do need to have, however, and I think maybe this gets to the heart of your question is, there are some levels at which there is no choice but to coordinate and to have some uniform, right? For example, like data from Europeans comes over to America, is mined here, and then is used to make decisions back in Europe. Who has jurisdiction over this? Well, really both sides have. So it's better to actually come to an agreement instead of having the fights that we've seen over time. However, I think the right time to come to that agreement is after or along with each country, each maybe organization figuring out what it really is that they want from AI. There's another very important theme in all of this is that like AI is a very young technology. And if we like there's now this incredible hurry to have a UN AI agency and whatnot, like we really don't know what the agency should be doing. Like let's just, things don't happen in 6 months. Like actually mistakes happen in 6 months. Good things take longer to happen. So let's be a little bit more thoughtful about this.
Hey, a question for Jack about liability. So in your article, you say that according to agency law, companies are only liable for agents, for the acts of their agents are within the scope of their agents' employment. Given that a lot of these companies, such as OpenAI, their mission is to develop artificial general intelligence and release general purpose foundation models. Given that mission and like the generality of those models, how does agency law apply in those cases?
It's a really interesting question, and I appreciate you asking it. So I think, these are always questions of facts and circumstances. It's a good point that if the mission statement is artificial general intelligence, perhaps that's a broader remit for something like an AI agent. But I still do think that there are important questions to be asked in that context. For example, has AGI actually been achieved there? So it might be something that is aspired to, but if the tool is simply a chatbot trained on the documents of a particular financial firm for private wealth management, I think that's a very different category, regardless of what the company that produced it is ultimately striving towards. And I also think that there's important questions of disclaimers on the part of the AI provider in terms of what they're actually, the terms of use for a particular customer interaction would be very important there as well.
Let me add one thing to that. You are right that the goal of these models is to be very, very general. As general as human intelligence is. And then, in fact, that is one of the best things about them. But to my mind, actually, there is a reason to not regulate them as such. Specific applications might need regulations to be adaptive for the case where they're done with AI. In many cases, whether something is done by AI or not just doesn't matter. But trying to regulate large language models or AI or generative AI per se is a little bit like trying to regulate mathematics. It's like mathematics is very widely applicable. We don't regulate it or restrict it because bad guys might make use of it. They will, but it's not mathematics' fault. Or maybe to take another example, people like to make these strange comparisons between AI and nuclear weapons, right? There's a distinction between nuclear weapons and quantum mechanics. Nobody regulates quantum mechanics, right? Or programming languages, like I can use Python to do very good things and very bad ones, The place where the regulation needs to happen is the application. It's not the Python itself. And the same, only more so with AI.
And just to build off of that, I think that's a problem that we've seen in many policy proposals so far, is the difficulty in defining AI in a way that does not kind of scope in, you know, math or algorithms or any kind of number of products that we're already used to. Oftentimes, even when something is trying to target a specific application, because of the nature of the definitions, it may apply much more broadly to many technologies that we're already used to and already using in our everyday lives. And again, that's where really considering the trade-offs and what this could mean for consumers as well as for innovation is going to be critically important.
Any additional questions? This will be the final question, I believe.
Wow, the final question. Make it a good one. I'm a little bit bemused by how this term AI has grown in very recent times, whereas we've been using AI in various forms for quite some time, for decades, in fact. And when we look at medical imaging or satellite imaging, that kind of AI has been used for, and this has practically been used, successfully been used for some time. Now, you're saying, or one of you on the panel at least is saying, the difference is now in terms of oral intelligence, which is certainly not something that's been there for decades, or the fact that we have continuing lower cost implementation, so it will be more broadly applied. But technology, at least, you mentioned nuclear power. Now, nuclear power has international standards, even though various countries have a societal difference in terms of what risk they will accept. We have an active, this is a technology, some other you have mentioned, we have an active process for creating international standards, which is built on national standards, but it's not easy, it takes time, but it's been very successfully applied. Therefore, I don't believe the concept that this is a new technology and has some personal use can't be subject to international standards is really consistent with past history in those areas.
Maybe I should, clarify what I said before. I was making a distinction between nuclear weapons and quantum mechanics. We don't have international standards about quantum mechanics. We do about nuclear weapons. So there will be many applications of AI where, as we've discussed before, it will be good to have some international agreement. The question is whether those should be about AI per se. In your question, you actually bring up a very important point, which, I would urge everybody to keep in their minds, which is that there is a very strong tendency, again, for people who weren't accompanying this for the last many decades, to think that LLMs or generative AI are AI. The vast majority of AI has nothing to do with that. And the vast majority of AI looks nothing like a human being. It's just, applications to a lot of different things. And if we try to regulate or legislate, AI by these very broad, very loose, very unclear definitions, while having in mind only one narrow type of what it is, like, this is just going to do incredible damage. And how could it not? So that is actually the main thing that I would urge caution about.
Okay, I'd like to thank our panelists for a very wide-ranging discussion. And I think what was clear throughout this discussion is that there are a lot of topics involved with AI, and really only scratched the surface of many of the policy implications on talking about these. Love to continue the conversation. I'm going to point out Anne and Maria, who can wave their hands over there, who are government relations folks with the Cato Institute. Feel free to reach out to them if you'd like to speak further with us on these topics. Reach out to us directly. There are some articles on the table that have been recently written by the folks on the panel here if you'd like to learn more. And I think there's a lot more to talk about on these topics. So thank you very much for attending, and we hope to engage with you more.